Hello and welcome to another episode of Conduit Conversations for 2022, bringing you pioneers at the cutting edge of social change. I'm Paul Finsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a home for people passionate about positive impact. My guest today is Jenny King, head of civic action and education at the Institute of Strategic Dialogue, leading their efforts to translate research into frontline programming and response. Jenny provides regular briefings for UK government departments and regulators on approaches to media literacy, as well as overseeing the ISD's growing portfolio on climate mis- and disinformation, supporting a worldwide coalition identifying and analysing counter-related harms. Welcome, Jenny.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so let's sort of set out the stall. We know that climate is the existential challenge of our times. We know the scale of the problem. The science tells us what we have to do. It's pretty clear what we have to do both to reduce emissions and to offset. We know how to finance it. We know within a broad degree of approximation what the technologies are. We know what technologies we need to rapidly scale into and where we need to make breakthroughs. If we had all the political will in the world, we could probably buy a tiny sliver, sneak in and save ourselves. Unfortunately, and that is the topic of today's conversation, we don't have all the political will in the world. The facts are unassailable, but we know that there's no necessary correlation between facts, people's beliefs, and then how they act. And one of the main culprits for that is the way people acquire and consume information. And that in turn is significantly impacted by climate information, misinformation and disinformation. So let's start with some definitional questions. What is disinformation and misinformation in the climate space? And then we're going to discuss a little bit of how big a problem this really is.
Sure. So it is very important when you're talking about anything to do with the information environment that you have very, very clear parameters, because it is all too easy to get wrapped around the axle with claims that this is about censoring certain opinions from the public commons, or that you don't want good faith debates. And of course, that is not what anybody is advocating. There are plenty of aspects around climate change policy and what makes sense at the domestic or the international level that does need to be discussed. And there are definite trade-offs that need to be explained to the public and well articulated and thought through and voted on. And you need a strong public mandate for this kind of action. But that's not what we're talking about in this instance. And the coalition of organizations that ISD has been working with on climate specifically came up with a definition that we felt really covered three key axes of the problem. And for us, we define it as deceptive or misleading content. That's on the first pillar, and this is probably the most traditional universe of content around climate change, is content that undermines the existence or the impacts of climate change as a phenomenon, the unequivocal human influence on climate change, and the need for corresponding urgent action, which, as you say, has been very clearly defined by the IPCC and is enshrined in things like the Paris Agreement. So that's your kind of outright climate denial, climate is a hoax, climate skepticism. The second pillar is content that misrepresents scientific data, including by omission and cherry picking, and that we can pick up on that later, in order to erode trust in climate science, climate-based institutions, and the experts who are at the forefront of this policy discussion. And then the third is content that falsely publicizes efforts as being pro-environmental, that in fact are not substantiated by science or contribute to climate warming and contravene the scientific consensus. And that's where you get your greenwashing, your industry-sponsored advertising and PR and marketing efforts, your vested interests who are trying to maintain the status quo. So that's how we delineate between these different types of content.
Fabulous. Okay, so now let's try and break down how significant a problem this is and the impact of it. Because in some ways, you'd be out of a job and we wouldn't be very concerned if there are, you know, small little cottage industry of quacks and flat earthers who are going around saying things that are palpably untrue and unscientific. My sense is that it is more serious than that in a big way. So tell us about this phenomenon. I mean, has there been any effort to measure it and quantify it and assess its impact? Tell us.
I think we're at a really pivotal juncture, and that 2022 is a historic year because this is the first time ever that the IPCC has recognized climate mis and disinformation as an active barrier to action. So in the report that was 3,000 plus pages long, I'm sure you've read it from cover to cover. That came out earlier this year, they absolutely, explicitly and unequivocally said that pollution of the public commons and the way that vested interests and particularly, you know, traditional industries have made an effort to confuse the public about the realities of climate change and the viable solutions is preventing the kind of meaningful legislation and policy that we need to action in this very, very rapidly closing window. So, you know, you don't need to take it from us. That is the multilateral body that all governments have bought into as being the arbiter of where we stand as a set of nations on climate action. And I really think that reflects the fact that we're sitting essentially in the gap, the enthusiasm gap, I would call it, between having consensus on climate change as a problem and actually being able to implement meaningful solutions. And over the last 3-4 decades, we've seen a massive evolution in public opinion on this issue. And the reality is if you look at all major polling, including there was a study that was done by UNDP and the University of Oxford last year that involved millions of people in 50 countries around the world. And it showed that there is overwhelming consensus that people both believe in the reality of climate change and believe that there should be government mandated action or government led action and response to tackle this urgently. However, there is a very big difference between landing that idea and actually getting to the point where you have a coherent and bold legislative agenda that deals with all of the various different parts of this problem and in a substantive way. And that's where the information efforts and the malign information efforts sit currently, is exploiting the gap between buy-in and actual action. And I think there's an understanding that they sort of lost the first battle, which was trying to deny that climate change existed at all. And that was clearly where efforts lay in the 80s and the 90s and the early noughties. And to a large extent, that has now been pushed to the fringes of public debate. It's no longer particularly palatable as a stance, and it's not going to gain a huge amount of traction with the general public. You'll still see it, 100%. And a lot of the pundits who are still seen as credible commentators in this space, if you look at their back catalogue, they all espoused versions of climate denial and climate doubt somewhere in the, you know, shadowy past. But now they realise that that's not the way to gain traction with the public. And instead, the way to do it is to plant seeds of doubt about the viability of the solutions that are on the table and about the impact that it's going to have on individual people's lives. And that exploits a lot of themes that are already gripping countries, that are fueling polarization, things to do with autonomy, civil liberties, individual freedom, agency, state-citizen relations, power, you know, these hugely emotive and visceral topics that can be weaponized and channeled in a lot of different directions and are now being channeled towards climate delayism, as we would call it.
Okay, but I'm trying to understand, there's one theory of the world, right, which is you take in any matter of public concern, you discuss the contours of what's happened. You present the facts in the most compelling way possible. There's a clash of ideas, and the best ideas win. And if we're going to have a big public debate, you know, we could have a debate about tax policy or ways to regulate intellectual property or how to regulate genomics. And a bunch of deeply expert people could reasonably disagree, and it would be an interesting debate. If you're going to debate me on whether there is climate change, and you've just cited the UNDP and Oxford study, which says that the overwhelming majority of people in the world believe that there is, then why is it that we aren't just crushing the other side, right? Because the asymmetry is such that we have all the facts and we have public opinion and they haven't got either of those things. So what is it about this moment in history that is giving them a fighting chance? Why are they the David to our factual Goliath?
I mean, it's the million-dollar question, but I think that there are a lot of relatively easy answers to that question. The first is that there has always been a disproportionate level of financial and resource-based investment in people who want to maintain the status quo. And that's not only the carbon majors, so, you know, the 100 companies that are cited as being responsible for 70% of historic emissions, but it's also those who benefit politically or otherwise from the, you know, the continuation of reliance on certain technologies. And they do continue to invest millions and millions of pounds. And the climate sector, for all of its good ideals and facts and enthusiasm, is not, in my experience, particularly cash rich.
But let's stop you there. So let's just take them one at a time, right?
Sure.
If the argument is that they've got more money than we have, that can't be right. Because if you think of all of civilization's resources to combat this threat, and then there's a rump industry, really a powerful, well-funded industry that can throw, that has free cash flow coming from the sale of oil and gas and the power of incumbency. But just in terms of available resources, if it were just the fact of resources, then I would feel quite confident about that, because I think that we would be able to dwarf and match it, because after all, there are tens of millions of, hundreds of millions of people whose lives are at stake who agree this is a problem. And their governments and institutions and, frankly, capital, which is also invested in a green future. So why is it that what is it about this resource imbalance that seems to me to be solvable?
I'm not saying it's insolvable, yeah. but I do think it's the reality of where we are currently in terms of our media and information ecosystems. And I think that there is a big difference between the kinds of grassroots support that you might have, as you're saying, coming from hundreds of millions of people around the world, versus those who can immediately tap into the kinds of high traction and high volume platforms, either in the legacy media or via social media, that give them undue and disproportionate influence in the public debate. So it's about, where are the amplifiers, where are the megaphones that make certain opinions or stances louder within, you know, the way that we discuss public policy at both the domestic and the international level. So I think that's one thing, is that the resources are very centralized, that community of vested interests are quite coordinated in terms of all moving towards a similar agenda. They are a very mutually reinforcing community. So they will cross-cite each other's content. They will appear in each other's, in each other's media. And there is a sense of great coherence and strategy in that respect, which is not necessarily the case for, you know, a ragtag group of people at the grassroots who are climate activists. The other thing is that they never need to really engage at a substantive level with climate policy. I had a partner in the US describe this to me in a really brilliant way last year when they said, "Jenny, we never actually make it to talking about climate policy because we're stuck in the antechamber of discussion, which is just about climate policy as a philosophical notion and who gets to be involved in that discussion at all. That's where we're sitting. We're sitting in the culture wars, identity politics, grievance politics space, and you're trying to bring basically the knife of science to the gunfight of the culture wars." And that is, I think, the other major axis of this, which is that on the one side, you have extremely difficult to understand and highly nuanced climate science. And on the other hand, you have people who are making emotive and really powerful and impactful arguments about cost of living, about the material changes that people are going to see in their everyday lives, about, you know, the impacts on their children, about their freedom of movement. And what we saw around COP26, this was so clearly demonstrated, because we had coded all of these, you know, keyword lists and narratives around specific aspects of negotiations. on the assumption that there would be coordinated disinformation campaigns around, for example, carbon markets, Article 6 of the COP26 agreement, loss and damage, all of these contentious areas. And almost no content came through on any of those, what we were calling threat vectors. Almost everything sat in that culture war space of talking about climate change or climate policy as in terms of hypocrisy and elitism, using absolutist arguments that said, well, we don't need to do something because we've already fulfilled our obligations and it's now the China and India need to step up, or using, you know, other arguments around they want to take away your meat, they want to take away your cars. So you're operating on a completely different terrain.
Okay. So the reason I'm going to adopt this role as the sort of pushback skeptic in this conversation is not because I'm not on your side of the table. I want to get more clarity about why we're losing. Mm-hmm. Because let's just try and, as I understand it, pass out your arguments. So the first one is coordination. We can be coordinated. Like, there's nothing about the nature of this argument which says they have some structural benefits in being coordinated in the way that we can't. Let's talk about the emotional arguments. I mean, we could sit and war game out the emotional arguments around fires and floods and food systems and your grandchildren inheriting a wasteland. We have way better emotional arguments. We have much, much, much better emotional arguments. So what I'm interested in is, and here's a working hypothesis, that our side, which is the sides of facts, science, and planetary and human existence, has gone to sleep, is negligent, is not devoting sufficient resources. And if we woke up and devoted sufficient resources and claimed back the narrative upper hand, we should win on every front. So part of what I'm interested in is there something about the way the architecture of information, about the way it's distributed, about this particular moment in human history, particularly around social media and micro-targeting, which makes this a more devilish problem? Because everything that you've said so far is reasons why they're winning, but they're reasons why they're winning because we are not, you know, we're bringing a bowl of Jell-O to a knife fight. You know, that's what we're doing. But there's nothing that can stop us from bringing a gun. So tell me, is there something else going on here that's actually deeper and more difficult than just matching argument for argument, resource for resource, narrative device for narrative device? Come on, guys.
I mean, I do think that that is an issue across a number of progressive policy areas, that, you know, we have somehow ceded the equal playing field on the communications ground. And you see that playing out in a number of, you know, European, North American, Asia Pacific, and many other global contexts, where the media ecosystem now seems extremely weighted in one direction in terms of the force of the arguments being made. But if you look at the digital environment, it is absolutely the case that the system is also biased towards, or seems to incentivize and value, certain types of content that are more incendiary, that are more divisive, and that fit into this kind of culture wars and grievance politics type content than the sober, scientific, you know, verified arguments that might be coming from credible institutions. One example I can give you is during COP26, we compared the 7 authoritative pages that Facebook has formally included in its much touted Climate Science Center, which is its flagship initiative to try and steer its users towards verified information on this issue. And we counterbalance that, or try to benchmark it against 7 pages that we knew had a track record of espousing climate skepticism or actively spreading discourses of delay, as we would call them, or climate mis and disinformation. So that could be people like Breitbart London, Spiked Online, Tucker Carlson, you know, those who had been well documented by the climate sector. And we found that to an order of magnitude, the disinformation pages were not only posting with more frequency and volume during this really pivotal moment, the climate summit, but also that their posts were gaining exponentially more traction. Now, the sites in the Climate Science Centre are supposedly being pushed by the platform itself, and yet are still being outperformed at every stage by these pages that are repeat offenders and super spreaders of misinformation, not only on climate science, but across a whole range of issues.
Why?
Without being able to lift up the hood on the social media platforms, it is extremely difficult for us to give a definitive answer to that. And I don't want to, you know, give you a trite response, because all of the evidence that we are gaining to date across a range of issue sets implies that there is a certain dynamic playing out in the way that algorithmic amplification works, in the way that certain content seems to be brought to the surface and amplified, and that people are encouraged to engage with it, and that it's rewarding that kind of content. But as soon as you levy those claims against the platforms, they'll say, well, you don't have all of the information because you're not seeing what we're seeing at the back end. But there is also no transparency or availability of more complex system level data for researchers and sort of vetted, trusted regulators and institutions to make those kind of determinations.
So I love your example, the seven pages of the deniers versus the seven pages of science, and the deniers are killing it, right? Now, if there is a highly sophisticated factory of people like the GRU or some kind of Russian group of people in a warehouse somewhere who are kind of manufacturing it and using all these incredibly sophisticated algorithmic techniques to do it, that may or may not be there, but if this is being driven in a focused, intelligent, concerted way, there is no reason why we can't set up the counter group to do, and there's no reason why our arguments have to be bland and vanilla and scientific. We can deploy equally emotive, backed by science, arguments, which should scare the bejesus out of people and mobilize them to action. So I'm still interested in why are they, what is it about them that is winning that we're losing when we have potentially all the money and all the facts and all of civilization on our side?
So one thing that I'd like to pick up on in what you said is this notion, which I think is still a very 2016 conception of disinformation, which is the idea that there are teams of people sitting in some, you know, snow-capped Kremlin-based warehouse pushing this. The barrier to entry for producing disinformation is exceptionally low. And the idea that you need sophisticated coordination is not borne out at all anymore. The reality is that anyone can do it, and the reward structure for doing it and the permission structure for doing it online is very open. So we have not detected so far the idea of sort of malign coordinated influence in the sense of astroturfing or using bot networks or any of these ideas that, oh, it's something that can be pinpointed and we can say, well, that's an active violation of terms of service. What we are talking about in many cases are high traction, verified blue tick accounts who have incredible organic reach to begin with. You know, if you take a pundit, for example, like Jordan B. Peterson, across his various social media accounts, he boasts over 10 million followers. And he's what we would call a non-climate influencer, in the sense that his legacy position as a commentator in the public space has not been to talk about climate particularly, hasn't been his area of interest, hasn't been something that he's focused on, hasn't been something that he's built his brand or his reputation around. But over the last 12 to 18 months, he suddenly pivoted a huge amount of his rhetoric into looking at climate within his broader worldview and ideology and what climate says about, you know, woke culture or cancel culture or sort of liberal fanaticism, the way that we get cultish about certain policy areas. And as soon as he becomes a vector for that kind of conversation, and as soon as he starts challenging the viewpoints of the pretty marginal fringe people who don't have a huge amount of organic reach themselves, he's galvanized an audience who would never have been engaged in this discussion before and may never have had exposure to that kind of content. And that's why we're working on completely unequal grounds. You know, who are the figureheads that can immediately boast that kind of following across not only mainstream media, YouTube, Facebook, TikTok, Twitter, but also the fringe sites that most, you know, most people in the scientific space would never touch with a barge pole, Discord, Gab, you know, these spaces that are quote unquote alternative tech, where very specific communities hang out with each other and exist in a relative echo chamber that can engender quite extreme and radical positions.
Okay, so now I think I'm getting closer, at least in my mind, to the nature of the problem. Because for every, you know, one of the kind of right-wing criticisms of the media and the Hollywood industrial complex is that there's a kind of left-wing bias in culture, right? So for every Jordan B. Peterson, there is a Beyoncé, right? And if you were to amass all the largest social media accounts in the entire world, and then, this is a thought experiment, and then assign them a left-right vector, right, orientation, I suspect we probably get more left than right. So for every sort of climate, you know, woke, warrior against wokeism turn climate denier that we can cite, we can turn the culture industry around and say, this is a deep and existential problem. We should be fighting it. And so there's nothing to me there that says we can't. I keep coming back to this theme of, is there something structural that is at play here? Because if we have voices and influences and money and narrative drift, we should be able to win. And where I'm getting to, and I'd love your reaction to this, is for the first time in human history, we have an information architecture, which means once I'm communicating with you and once you're following me and I have a whole ideological coalition of thoughts that are anti-woke, anti the left, denial of racism and slavery, pro-police and in favor of climate denial. Just pick some. Maybe unfair to kind of put them all in one category, in favor of torture, in favor of the war against terror, or taking extreme measures. Once you capture people in that information echo chamber, you've got them. And getting them out of that information echo chamber takes 50x resources, or maybe 100x, or maybe 1,000,000x resources. And so what we're in is a world where you have a lock, you have a heuristic lock on groups of people. And it only takes 20% or 30% of a society to be heuristically locked for you to have a real problem. And there aren't a really strong available set of strategies to unlock because of the asymmetry and because of the nature of the way information dissemination works once you have laid down a pathway.
A lot of this really is about credible intermediaries, right? In the public domain. Who do people trust?
Yeah.
And as things like the Edelman Trust Barometer, for example, will tell you, we're seeing an unprecedented erosion of trust in governments and in institutions. And that is very fertile ground for those who would like to insert and normalize and launder what were previously extreme ideologies into the mainstream. I'll give you one really clear example that links what we've experienced during the pandemic with climate change. So we did a large piece of research around a conspiracy called climate lockdown, which is the implication that the kind of public health measures you saw during COVID-19 were sort of a test bed or just a shadowy precursor of the real tyranny that is coming down the line under the auspices of climate change. And there were a lot of communities that formed over the course of 2020 and 2021 in opposition to public health mandates, whether it was lockdowns, whether it was vaccine regimes, whether it was other policies that were being instituted. And there was a genuine and very real, and in many cases very valid, trauma that was experienced by hundreds of thousands, if not tens of millions of people around the world in relation to that global crisis. Those communities, as the pandemic started to become a less prominent issue in public life, and as, you know, lockdowns were eased and as infection rates went down, those communities existed. Those Facebook pages with hundreds of thousands of people existed. And suddenly you saw the narratives being pivoted and that anger and grievance being pivoted towards, well, have you guys thought about climate change? That's where the next battleground is. That's where they're going to come and seize your rights now. That's where they're going to come and take away the things that you care about and the things that you hold dear. So you have a formation of a community around a very specific event, but suddenly that's been used as an opportunity to galvanize an entirely new audience who may well have either never been interested in climate change before in a particularly concerted way, or might even define themselves as pro-environmental, but are truly traumatized by this event that has affected all of us in really profound ways, and can now be pivoted into the next issue. And that's not just climate. That can be sexual and reproductive health rights. That can be migration. That can be electoral integrity. But there's a kind of captive audience ready and waiting. And you see the infiltration of these narratives into spaces that are preformed and, as you say, almost kind of hermetically sealed. So we saw climate lockdown start from a very small group of dedicated actors who were just so committed to making this happen, and finally, after about 6 months of trying, managed to land it and create a reactionary dynamic with the quote-unquote mainstream media. Then it was picked up by your Fox Newses, your, you know, OANs, the kind of conservative media ecosystem. But where does it end up at the end of this journey, or at least where we stopped monitoring? In the QAnon Telegram groups, in the anti-vax groups, in the anti-migration groups, right? So it's not really about climate. It's about how climate can be used as a symbol of things that are already dividing people and polarizing communities.
Super clear. Super clear. So now we're going to pivot to solutions. Mm. What are the proposed policy solutions to this?
So the very first one is we need the definition that I described at the beginning, adopted by some sort of multilateral institution that has credibility in this space. To my mind, the only reason why you've seen any movement on counteracting public health mis and disinformation around COVID-19 or cracking down on, you know, electoral fraud narratives, false electoral fraud narratives on social media is because they could lean on organizations like the World Health Organization or the CDC or, you know, national electoral commissions, which gave them the cover to make changes to their terms of service and their community guidelines. As we know, because Mark Zuckerberg says it every day, given the opportunity, they do not want to be the arbiters of truth, and they do not want to wade into these hugely fractious debates and be seen as censoring discourse. So what they need is something that they can turn to and say, well, we are relying on this definition by an organization that is completely independent, that multiple governments buy into, and who are ultimately responsible for leading the charge on this issue set. So we would like to see a definition and set those parameters clearly within either the IPCC or the UNFCCC or by the COP presidency, and to have it recognized in something like the negotiated outcomes of the next summit in Sharm el Sheikh.
Got it.
That's number one.
Number one. Number two.
Number two is we then need that formalized and adopted within social media terms of service, and we need proper enforcement of those regulations. Now, I am not advocating for, and I want to be really clear, that people should be deplatformed or this content necessarily has to be removed, and that that is the solution here. What we are talking about is enforce your own terms of service. If you are Facebook and you have a policy which says an account that is proven 5 times in a row to have posted content rated false by our independent fact checkers, we will take punitive action on that account, for example, by downranking or demonetizing that content, do it. Because we have scores of examples where that's been the case, and somehow they've still been allowed to spread content with impunity and reach hundreds of millions of people. So do what you say you're going to do, but also explicitly codify climate mis and disinformation as a distinct pillar of harm, and don't just kind of put it into this amorphous blob of mis and disinformation content.
Got it.
So that's number two. And really, taking action on repeat offender and super spreader accounts would have a force multiplier effect, because these people are perpetrators, as I said earlier, across so many different vectors of harm. If you acted on the 30 to 50 accounts that we found are responsible for originating or amplifying almost all of the high traction content in this space, you would completely change the entire playing field for this discussion. Like, we found that just 16 accounts on Twitter outperformed 148 other accounts in their own community of sort of climate skepticism in terms of interactions. That's how disproportionate this very, very small community of dedicated people are. So that's sort of the next thing. And then there are ongoing discussions that don't just relate to climate change, but are absolutely critical in how we quantify and conceptualize and analyze this problem, which is about the transparency of data that is released by social media platforms for us to understand what is going on, whether there is active manipulation or something inherent in the architecture of their services and products, which is enabling this division, which is enabling incendiary and false and misleading content to gain undue influence in the space. And that there are plenty of schemes that you could set up which would not compromise the privacy of user data. So, for example, providing dummy data that kind of anonymizes what you're being given as a vetted researcher, but still allows you to do trend analysis that would help us to really understand and get to grips with the nature of the problem in a way that is beyond anecdotal. And then finally, there are some changes to the APIs, the application programming interfaces of the platforms, that could really simply be implemented that would help us to track disinformation campaigns in real time. For example, a huge amount of the campaigns that we saw around COP26 were image or video based, but it is extremely difficult at the moment to track the spread and the cross-fertilization of that imagery, both within and across platforms, which meant that we were having to do these hugely labor-intensive manual searches to work out how viral, you know, a fake, falsely attributed image of private jets lining up at Glasgow Airport that actually dated back to 2015 was, and how much it was influencing public understanding of the summit. That's a really small change that the platforms could make, and it would help us to understand and ultimately to respond to those in campaigns in real time. Same thing around the Texas blackouts. The image that claimed, you know, wind turbines were being de-iced by diesel-fueled helicopters, which had been used since 2013 whenever the opportunity arose, and became the dominating narrative of this really tragic and very disruptive event in Texas that, you know, caused a large number of fatalities and a huge amount of pain for families. We would have been able to respond to that so much better if we could track immediately how much it was spreading, where it was spreading, how it was originating, how it was cross-pollinating across communities. But we couldn't do it because we didn't have access to, you know, that particular aspect of the API. So there are both regulatory responses here, but also specific things that the tech platforms could do without needing to be pushed or held to account by governments. And we could begin tackling that tomorrow.
So tell us a little bit about the role of ads and ad tech in fueling and contributing to this problem.
I didn't mention it earlier, and I do think it's a really important part of the ecosystem, which is how much money is being spent on advertising and how much the online ad tech architecture, which is incredibly opaque and difficult to understand, yeah, enables and incentivizes scammers, fraudsters, and mis- and disinformation in two ways. Firstly, because you continue to monetize sites that are known for spreading that content, and advertisers have no idea that they are being shown next to that kind of content. So there was a study that was done last year which indicated that £2.6 billion is being spent advertising on mis- and disinformation sites, largely unbeknownst to those particular companies. And we have these incredible examples that the Conscious Advertising Network have pulled. For example, where the Forestry Commission will be shown in an advert on a YouTube video that is advocating for climate denial. You know, the irony is so acute. And the other way is that we still allow fossil fuel industries and their known and documented front groups to channel huge amounts of money into spreading their own narratives across social media platforms. So a partner of ours called EcoBotNet did a study from Q1 to Q3 in last year, and they found that just 16 companies had posted 1,700 ads on Facebook alone, and those had 150 million impressions. And more importantly, they'd made nearly £5 million for Meta as a company. So they are benefiting from continued efforts to confuse the public, particularly about viable solutions and that kind of greenwashing, wokewashing space that makes it more and more difficult to actually have a sober conversation about the science.
Let me come back and ask you a final question mm-hmm. in relation to the definition of misinformation. You said it at the top of the show. Would you mind just reading me the first part of your proposed definition?
Sure. So we say that climate myths and disinformation refers to deceptive or misleading content that undermines the existence or impacts of climate change, the unequivocal human influence on climate change, and the need for corresponding urgent action.
Okay. So you said something really, really interesting about climate lockdown. And here I think, without wanting to prognosticate too much, is the next challenge. If everything that you advocated for came to pass, which would require a colossal lift and would be one of the great triumphs of our time, but let's say you won and I was at the regulatory receiving end of this, I think what I would do is go exactly to the climate lockdown question. Because what I would do there is I would be saying, okay, climate change is coming. And you know what's going to happen is as these storms brew, these malevolent governments are going to come and they're going to use this terrible thing that's happening to take away your liberty, to increase your power bills, to regulate what you can eat, and to cross-fertilize that with all the other fears around the other, around refugees, around all the things that coexist in this kind of information ecosystem. And I think you can probably get quite a lot of virality and traction around that. And I don't think that any of that trips up your definition. I don't think you can take that to Mark Zuckerberg and go, you see this? You have to stop that because it's the second bounce of the ball on climate that is no less dangerous, compelling, and can have no less of an impact on the willingness of people to vote for politicians who all are in one category, who, amongst other things, will try and address climate change.
So it would definitely fit more into the second pillar of the definition, which is around the misrepresentation of scientific data in order to erode trust in institutions. And there were certainly instances within the lockdown conspiracy where there were either falsified ad hominem attacks on particular individuals or a total reframing and decontextualization of things that had been said by institutions. But I think you are absolutely right. And when ISD works on disinformation writ large as a problem, we always caution against an overfixation on particular pieces of content because it obscures the bigger problem, which is that this is about, you would often hear it called an ABC problem. It's about actors, it's about behavior, and it's about content. So this isn't a case of us sitting in a room and taking a bunch of individual posts and holding them up to, you know, the head of Twitter or the head of Facebook and saying, you know, does this or does this not violate the definition? That is one aspect of it. And we think it would at least go part of the way because there is plenty of content that could be less equivocal and could be dealt with quickly. So, you know, solve the problem that's there, the low hanging fruit that's there. But the bigger problem that you're talking about is the co-option of all critical policy areas into a divisive culture wars frame, which goes back to what I was talking about earlier. And that's where you have much bigger problems that need to be solved around the way that the media operates and how it is held to account by regulators. So, you know, one of the other recommendations we have in the report is that all of the seismic tech regulation that is currently going through governments, for example, the Digital Services Act in the EU, the Online Safety Bill in the UK, and other parallel versions around the world, is that they should not have out-and-out loopholes and exemptions for media outlets. And that is a very fraught discussion, and, you know, we won't have time to talk about it today. And there are, you know, very, very good reasons for preserving the Fourth Estate and making sure that you don't have erosion of freedom of speech. But we also know that media outlets can be major perpetrators themselves, and that they shouldn't be allowed, considering the role and the trust that they engender with the public and the ability that they have to reach huge numbers of people, that they also have to be held to account. So there are lots of different parts of our social architecture and the way that we have decided to talk or begun to talk about policy issues that needs to be solved beyond looking at definitions. But we're talking about what could we as a coalition help to shift the dial on. And, you know, there are sub problems that are ultimately beyond the auspices of an individual organization. We're talking about democratic decline, really. We're talking about the fracturing of society. We're talking about the shift from issue-based polarization to effective or identity-based polarization. These are things that need to be tackled far beyond the climate sector and certainly far beyond the auspices of an organization like ISD. But that is ultimately the bigger picture and the enabling environment. However, that doesn't mean, and that shouldn't give them a get-out clause to say that the types of policy asks and recommendations we're making are not still meaningful steps in the right direction.
So Jenny King, that's been a fascinating conversation. I've been so grateful for your time. I think the suite of policy recommendations you make, I'm certain would make a big difference. And I think inviting a future conduit conversation is to tackle what you ended with, which is, I am utterly convinced that we live in an age where, unique in the evolution of human history, where we have a way of communicating with and micro-targeting people in ways that we just reinforce perpetually a pre-existing set of views. And that dislodging those views once set, because of the information architecture that currently exists, is extraordinarily hard and almost by definition resistant to fact, to resources, and to the democratic contestation of ideas. And that means that we have a polarization lock in our societies, that for which I think there are not really good policy remedies out there, partly because they are in tension with our deeply held commitment to freedom of speech, and partly because it would require of the platforms to re-architect themselves to convey a plurality of views in ways that they don't want to do, and it's hard to actually imagine what that looks like. But unless and until we do that, we are going to be in a world where 30 to 40% of our societies are likely to be climate skeptics, in societies where the lock has happened. Places where the lock hasn't happened yet, we have more room for maneuver. But where the lock has happened, and that lock is certainly in the United States, and it will be in some other jurisdictions, it may be in China, it may be in Russia, it may be places where it has consequence. And unlocking that, I think, is going to be the next frontier. And I hope that ISD does as sophisticated thinking on this as you have on the prior question, because I think that's a new frontier for us. But I'm incredibly grateful for your time. Super interesting conversation. And I'm sure that everybody will love it and listen to it and spread it to people who agree and disagree to the views that have been expressed. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Conduit Conversations. Please do subscribe. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. To learn more about Jenny and her work, please visit the Institute of Strategic Dialogue's website. And for more information about the Conduit and our community of changemakers, please visit theconduit.com.